Today's November 4th. It is a historic day, Tuesday morning. Our class in Shivim Panim, Sefer Breshit, the scholars curriculum of the Milton program. We're in the fourth unit. Remember the fourth unit, which is called the Curse of Canaan. And we're spending two classes on this unit. Last week was the introduction. Today we're continuing. And therefore, what we want to do is take a few minutes to review what we did last time. We certainly have to reread the verses just to get ourselves into it, and then go over the major development of ideas we saw in order to go on for today. So here we go. I'm going to read the verses. And the verses are in chapter 9 of Breishit, beginning with verse 18. Right, so I'm looking in the Tanakh, or in the Chumash, in the Bible, and I'm reading from Genesis chapter 9, verse 18. I'm going to read quickly because we've done this already last week just to refresh our memories. Here we go. The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Yafet. Ham being the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole world branched out. Noah, the tiller of the soil, was the first to plant the vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk, and he uncovered himself within his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness, and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Yafet took a cloth, placed it against both their backs, the word we said was Shechem, and walking backward, they covered their father's nakedness, their faces were turned the other way, so they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah woke up from his wine and learned what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves," or slave of slaves, literally, "shall he be to his brothers." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, let Canaan be a slave to them. May God enlarge Yafet, let him dwell in the tents of Shem. And let Canaan be a slave to them. Noah lived after this flood," etc., etc., etc. So we talked last week, very briefly, about the question of what is the sin here? What happened? What was done? When I said done, I already went too far. I shouldn't have said done, because the verse said that he saw, but then the verse says that he did, right? There's a contradiction there. In the description of events, it says that Ham saw, but then Noah knew what his youngest son had done to him. So we said that either we'll understand saw in terms of did, or did in terms of saw. And we didn't get into that last week. We just put the question on the table. The way we went on to develop something last week was we noticed the unbelievable, amazing parallels between this story and what other story? It's all Genesis, right? The creation story. We saw that just like Noah planted a garden, so God planted a garden. And we saw just like the story was about something that's eaten, so here it's something that's drunken. And we saw there's a midrash that makes the connection. It says, Noah, you should have been careful, you should have taken heed from the problems that Noah had with what he ate, drank, right? The assumption being there that the forbidden fruit was from the vine. But in the idea is that there's a parallel here, that something is going on at the center of the story is this eating. And furthermore, we said that in both stories, it's about sexual awareness. The tree of knowledge of good and evil, we showed that it's probably the tree of sexual awareness. Before they ate, they weren't aware, they weren't embarrassed. Afterwards, they were, had to clothe themselves. Also here, the whole story is about sexual awareness in some sense. We're not exactly sure how. We saw that over there, the result of the sin is a curse. Here, it's also a curse. We saw over there that the perpetrator tries to shirk off blame. The same thing here. Noah doesn't take blame upon himself, but puts it upon his son. And we saw a number of other parallels. So then we said, so what's the meaning of those parallels? What are we going to learn from this? Well, the first reaction was, both stories are stories of, in some sense, in some way, failure, sin, concerning with sexuality. But the difference is that story, at the beginning of Breishit, has all of the human race culpable. Adam and Eve, the only persons around, they sinned. Whereas in this story, well, two sinned, with Ham sinned, and to a certain degree, Noah, but two Yafet and Shem, not only did they not sin, but in some sense they redeemed the sin, or they redeemed themselves by not participating, and not just not participating, but by covering their father. So what I try to say is that this story sets out, or perhaps intends to set out, a topology of the way human history is going to develop. There's a certain branch of history that is accused of sexual impropriety, Ham, specifically Canaan, and there's another branch, Shem and Yafet, who are understood to be sexually chaste. Where do we get this reading from? The story of the rape of Dinah. Because there, later on in Genesis, we see that emphasis put on the fact that Dinah is, of course, from the children of Yaakov, who are the descendants of Shem. That's where we get the phrase Semites from. Shemites, right? Descendants of Shem, the Jewish people are from Shem. Whereas the rapist, not only is his name Shem, which is a word used here in this story, it means shoulder, but the Torah emphasizes that the rapist is one of the Hivites. And the Hivites are listed here as one of the seven descendants of Canaan. We saw that in verse 15, 16, 17. Genesis 10, 15, 16, and 17. So what we saw is that the story of the rape of Dinah is a flash forward. It's continuing on this dichotomy between the good guys and the bad guys, as it were, in the area of sexuality, between the sons of Canaan on the one hand and the sons of Shem on the other.
The curse is such a strong result of the act of sin. That I want to go back, if I may, to the act itself. When you see something you're not supposed to see, it's because you trespass into an area that you shouldn't have been. Is that the curse?
Is that the sin you mean?
Is that the sin?
We'll get to that today. We didn't deal with that last week, right? We've left that on the table. We just put out the questions on the table. That's for today. So thanks for getting us back on track. I just want to say one more thing to review. It'll take another 30 seconds, I think. We also saw last week that in the book of Leviticus, when the Torah has a whole chapter, chapter 18, devoted to incest, sexual impropriety, including homosexuality, that chapter begins and ends saying, do not do like the deeds of Egypt that you're coming from, and do not do like the deeds of Canaan that you're going into. And the chapter makes it clear that one of the major factors differentiating the Jewish people from Egypt, Egyptian culture and Canaanite culture, is the matter of sexuality. And that again goes right back to this chapter, the difference between Canaan, and the sons of Shem, the sons of the family of Shem. So that this story is setting up what happens later on in the Torah, that in matters of sexuality, don't be like the Egyptians who are sons of Ham. Right, did I get it right? Let's just write. Right, verse 6, 10:6. The Egyptians are sons of Ham, and don't be like the Canaanites, also sons of Ham, but be like the sons of Shem, those who are chaste. Okay, that's the review of last week. So now, continuing on, we were about last week to start talking about this question of, well, what actually happened? What's the problem? What's the sin? And like we said, two possibilities in theory, pulling the seeing in the direction of doing, or pulling the doing in the direction of seeing. Let's look at a Talmudic source here in the booklet and see what direction the rabbis of the Talmud pull it in. So we are on page, in the student reader, page 62. Page 62. And this is from the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Sanhedrin. And it goes like this. And Noach awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. That's a quote from the verse. It might be a different translation than the one we're used to, but it's the same verse. So it says, Rav and Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel were two Babylonian rabbis in the first generation of the writings of the Babylonian Talmud, we're talking about something like the year 220, 230, 240 of the Common Era. You have Rav and Shmuel, one maintaining that he castrated him, while the other says that he sodomized him. So either he took a knife and did something very, very serious to his father, or he simply sexually abused his father while his father was drunk. That's strong language. In other words, we're taking the words of Noach that he knew what his son had did to him. We're taking the did seriously. Notice that this midrash, this statement...
How did they conclude this?
Oh, wait a second. Wait a second. Let's see if we can find an answer to that. That's, of course, the most important question. Is there any basis for this? Is it just a fairy tale? Are they getting it from someplace?
Probably some Hebrew word that we aren't seeing and understanding.
Well, let's read on a little bit and see. But the first hint is that, again, it says that Noach knew what his son had done to him. Okay. So we read on. He who maintains that he castrated him reasons thus. Since he spoiled his plans for a fourth son, Noah cursed his fourth son. So what's bothering the author that causes the author to say it was a matter of castration? What is the point in the text? Yeah.
Well, if he saw him, or if Noah knew what his son did, he came in and stopped him and his wife from producing another son. So... therefore,
but you're not being close enough to the text. In the text, according to what we just read, what is the anchor? What is the place? What is the point in the text, the anomaly in the text that causing this rabbi to say that it was a matter of castration? It's something that bothered us last week. We talked about it last week.
Saw and did.
Say it again?
Saw and did.
No.
Being naked.
No.
We forgot. He told.
Say it again?
He told.
No. What is the textual anomaly? What in the story doesn't make any sense? And we asked about it last week.
Well, because how would he know what he did to him? He woke up, how did he know what he did?
No. Well, I'm a terrible teacher. I say no, 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 no. I'm not giving encouragement. I'll take another 10 seconds. Okay, tell you where it is. Tell you where it is. It's in verse...
He was covered.
It's in verse 25.
He cursed Canaan, who wasn't there at the time.
Right. Right. The textual anomaly is, the problem is, Ham sinned. Why did Noah curse Canaan?
The grandson.
Right. So the author of this text says, there must be a reason for that. There must be something in the crime that relates in some sense to the son of Ham, the son of the perpetrator. So the author of the text says, the person who is cursed, the grandson, the son of Ham, he is with what number son?
Four.
How do we know?
It tells you.
What does it tell me? What verse?
6.
Right, 10:6. Chapter 10, verse 6. The sons of Ham, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. We're assuming they're in order. Assuming that Canaan is the fourth son. So, the question is again, Noach knows that his son sinned. Why did Noach curse the fourth son of the sinner? So, the answer to the question's a good question. It's a serious question. We have to look for an answer. The answer is he cursed the fourth son of the perpetrator of the crime because the crime was in order to prevent Noah from having a fourth son. You might not like the answer, but the answer is a suggested answer to a real question. Right? It might be far-fetched as far as an answer goes, but it's a real answer, plausible answer to a real question. So, But he who says, I'm going back to the text to understand the other opinion, not the one about the castration, but the one about the sodomization. But he who says that he sodomized him, that all he did is somehow abuse his father sexually, homosexually, draws an analogy from the words, and he saw, occurring in two different places. Here it is written, and Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and it is written someplace else in a verse that we know, Shechem, the son of Hamor, saw her, who's her? Dinah, and took her and lay with her and violated her. So since we have this word saw in a sexual context in two places, by us and over there by the rape of Dinah, and saw there is a matter of sexuality, sexual intimacy, so it must be the same thing by us, say the rabbis. We're using the word as a bridge. And the truth is, we understand it's not just that word, but it's also another word that's the bridge, the word Shechem. That is the name of the boy that committed the rape, but it's also a central word in our story here in chapter 9. It means the shoulders that they put the cloak or the blanket on. So the rabbis are, I'll tell you what this is called in Hebrew, when we use a central word to connect two seemingly unrelated chapters. It's called in Hebrew, Gzeirah Shava. Gzeirah Shava. It's used again and again and again and again and again. It's hard for me to put on the board, so I'll just say it again. Gzeirah Shava. And certainly we'll come to that again. Okay.
Rob?
Yes?
I don't know if it's too early in the morning or this is a complex thought that my mind is not absorbing fully. I don't understand the sequence exactly. Would you mind just briefly?
No problem.
Do we understand the act that the sons observed is between a man and a woman, or we're now changing it to Noah being sodomized?
So at this point, we're not making any reference to Mrs. Noach.
Okay.
Not at all. Okay. We just have Noach in his tent, revealing himself naked, drunk, and it says that his son, his younger son, Ham, comes in and sees him. What does it mean? What does it mean? And both of the two interpretations here, both of them agree that seeing really means doing. And that is because, what it says later, that Noach woke up and realized what his son had done. So we're understanding that the word seeing is a euphemism for doing. But what is the doing? What is the doing? And there are two opinions, what is the doing? And each opinion has a leg to stand on. One opinion is that what he did is he sodomized him. He abused him when his father was unaware. And the quote-unquote proof of that is that the word saw here is used in our story, and that same word saw is used in a different story, and in a different story the word saw leads to rape. So it must be rape here also.
So the only characters we see in this scenario are in fact...
Men.
Men.
Yes.
So Noah is just... a hope, but not necessarily a fact.
You're right. In the next midrash, we'll see in another few minutes, she enters into the picture.
You know what? The fact that this is a story of sodomization, it's not a story of sodomization, but the fact that it's here would very much explain the sequence that follows with who we are supposed to lay with and who we're forbidden.
Very good point. Right. The what I had developed as far as what goes on later in Leviticus 18 really fits with what we have as a story of sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Right.
But didn't we say last week in the beginning that they went into his tent, but it was in her tent? So she might have...
Right.
So we don't know if it was just between
them. So this particular midrash that we read here from the Talmud Bavli, the Babylon Talmud, is not picking up on that point. But another midrash will. Another midrash that we'll see in another few minutes. We'll pick up on that point. So here we have the two opinions that it's just between men And it's a matter of doing. One opinion says the doing is sodomization, homosexual rape. And the other opinion says it's a matter of castration, which is more serious. So now, we saw a textual basis for this opinion that it's castration. And the textual basis was because the curse is on the fourth son, so that means Hamas have done something to prevent the birth of a fourth son. Okay, that's again an answer to a real question, but it is kind of a weak proof. Yes?
I just want to say that if Noah has sons that are old enough to have sons, I mean, I don't see why he's still having more children. He's got sons that have... At this point, does he have sons that already have sons already, right? So
yeah.
Sons are like our age. I mean, this man is Noah. He's like 70. He's still going to be
900 years old.
He was busy.
Yeah, but there's a big gap between that son and the fourth son.
Right.
I mean, there's like hundreds of years, it looks like, between the...
Remember that Avraham had his first son, Isaac, at the age of 100. And after the death of his wife, it goes on to say they took a few more wives and had lots of children. It's a different different culture. Say it again?
Might not
be our years. It's a whole different ballgame. So, I want to see in the book of Leviticus what might be another basis for this rabbinic opinion that we're talking about castration. Okay? So, and I think I put this on the sheets I gave out to you last week as the last source. If you don't have it in front of you, that's fine. I'll just read it to you. The source we want to look for is chapter 22 of Leviticus, verses 21 to 25. So I'll say that again. That's Leviticus 22. Verse 21 to 25. And again, we're turning to this as a possible foundation for the rabbinic opinion that the sin of Ham was castration. You ready? I'm going to read it. Anything blind, can't find the place.
Say one more time.
Leviticus, Vayikra 22, verse... 21. This will seem to have nothing to do with our subject, but it does have something to do with our subject. And when a man offers from a herd or a flock a sacrifice of well-being to the Lord, in Hebrew that's a korban shlamim, a sacrifice offered, for an explicit vow or a free will offering, it must be acceptable, be without blemish, there must be no defect in it, right? Sacrifices brought have to be pure. Anything blind or injured or maimed or with a wen, I don't know what that means, a boil scar or scurvy, such you shall not offer to the Lord. You shall not put any of them on the altar as offering by fire to the Lord. You may, however, present it as a free will offering, an ox or sheep with a limb extended or contracted, but it shall not be accepted for a vow. And here comes our verse. You shall not offer to the Lord anything with its testes bruised or crushed or torn or cut. You shall have no such practice in your land, nor shall you accept such animals from a foreigner for offering as food for your God. For they are mutilated, they have a defect, they shall not be accepted in your favor. Let me read it again. It's a little bit of explanation. It says that when you're offering an animal, right, it's an ox or sheep, going to verse 24, it can't be with its testes bruised, crushed, or torn, or cut. You shall have no such practice in your own land. Which seems to say you shouldn't be in the business of castrating animals, nor should you accept such animals from a foreigner. Which seems to indicate that foreigners do such things. Most or some of their animals are castrated. And we understand that in animal husbandry there are reasons to castrate animals. I'm not an expert, but I understand such things are done. Right? So Jews are forbidden, it seems to say, from castrating their animals, but others do it. And although it's allowed to accept on the altar sacrifices from non-Jews, but not if their animals are castrated.
And they castrate them to make them fat.
Okay, for whatever reason. But I learned from this that one of the distinctions that the Torah is setting up between the Jews and others is Jews don't castrate their animals, others castrate their animals. Which reminds me of what we read last week, and I mentioned it a few minutes ago in Leviticus 18, that one of the differences between Jews on the one hand and Canaanites and Egyptians on the other is Egyptians do all these abhorred, and Canaanites do all these abhorred sexual practices, and Jews don't. Ah. So if we've just learned that the Torah sets up castration of animals as one of the differences between Jewish practice and non-Jewish practice, and that's obviously connected to sexuality. So if we go back to our story of Noah and his sons, and we see that that story as a foreshadowing of the differences that will develop between the sons of Shem on the one hand and the sons of Ham, Canaan on the other hand, and we know that one of those differences is castration. You with me? One of the differences is castration. 100, 200, 300, 400 years down the line, we're going to read that difference back in to the fundamental story that describes the development of the differences between these two cultures. Of course it's a stretch. Of course it's a stretch. Of course it's a stretch. And we're going from animals to humans. But it all has to do with, again, with abhorrent sexual practices, whether it's sexual behavior or it's behavior towards the genitals. There are things that they do and Jews don't do. And this story here in chapter 9 is setting up that fundamental distinction between Jews and others. They do these things. They did it all the way back then. We don't do those things. And the truth is, we know, by the way, it's not just castration of animals that was in vogue among Canaanites and others, but also castration of human beings. Right? What is a eunuch? Right? If you go back to the Megillat Esther, the story of Esther, you have all those eunuchs running around the king's courtyard. Right? The idea is that Jews don't do those things. It's abhorrent. And it all goes back to, according to this approach, all goes back to this story in Genesis 9. Yes. Yeah?
Is it originally built for the next one? Maybe the image of God?
Is
that untouchable? I didn't answer immediately. Because.
That's one of the reasons why we don't do tattoos. A lot of things that we don't do go back to that basic concept. God created us to be sacred. We don't do those things that are part of the body.
Right.
We do circumcision, which is pretty close to castration. Right? I wonder if anyone would say that circumcision is the Jewish form of castration.
No.
I'm just trying to be provocative.
Okay.
I said, I wonder if anyone would say that circumcision is a Jewish form of castration. I was just trying to be provocative. You can strike it from the record. But Okay. So I wouldn't be quick to answer with an affirmative.
Well, it's not castration because you're not stopping someone from reproducing.
But you know what? Now we're going far afield. But I'll just tell you that the Rambam, Maimonides, says that the reason that Jews do circumcision is to limit sexual lust. He claims that we are literally blemishing the sexual organ in order to remove some pleasure and some lust from the male psyche. Is that true or not? I have no idea, and it's really relevant. Relevant. So anyway.
I want to say
yes.
About the castrating for animals, I can't
I can't begin to think that the Jewish slaughterhouse, the kosher one, only takes non-castrated steers. I mean, if that's a reach, is this supposed to hold true to nowadays that kosher meat would come from a non-castrated male?
All it says is that Jews don't do those things and don't accept those things on the altar. It never says we don't eat those things. And do we eat those things or not? I don't know.
We do. I can tell you that. Any male, a steer. A steer is a castrated male cow. And that's what goes to slaughterhouses, kosher or not. Mm.
Okay. So that doesn't necessarily contradict what the Torah said.
You can't honor God, though.
Right.
Right.
Okay, got it.
But it does seem to be rather cruel.
Yeah.
I mean,
it does.
Well,
did they give them painkillers?
You know what? It's very quick, and once it's done, then they develop into a very mild-tempered animal that's not going to fight, and it's going to have pleasant days. It's not going to be a competition.
They're facing their job, too, when they're having this
thing. Well, yes, they're aggressive, and it doesn't make a good meat animal, and it affects the...
Okay, look, that's the same reason they castrated the king's servants in olden times, so the king's servants wouldn't interfere with... So the king would have pleasant days.
That's right.
When did they stop sacrifice? After the destruction of the second temple?
With the destruction of the second temple in the year 70.
And then from that point on, in Jewish history,
there's
never been...
There's apparently never been sacrifice.
That we know of.
Yeah. Okay, so that unit is now behind us. We saw two
that
rabbinic...
Unit or that unit.
That unit. I said unit. I said...
Boy, that was a heavy unit.
But what about commentary 4?
We're not going to see commentary 4. We can't see everything. I think commentary 4 doesn't add really anything to what we've seen. We're going to see, though, we're going to see commentary 7.
7, okay.
Is that okay to go on?
Sure.
There is no rabbi who just thought we were dealing with a case of masturbation by Noah.
Oh, wait a second. Here we are. Here we are in 7. We're not going to read all of commentary 7 on page 64-5. We're going to read just the beginning of it. And as you can see, this is a non-Jewish commentary. That doesn't make it any less true, of course, or any less worthwhile. One of the major biblical commentators and critics of the 20th century in Germany. And he writes as follows, Klaus Westermann, the ancients were well aware of the effects of intoxication. They knew that wine could stupefy the senses and weaken the faculties and have other dangerous consequences which could result in one being uncovered without knowing. And this was something disgraceful. In the Ugaritic myth, the tale of Akt, the dutiful son is described as he who takes him by the hand when he is drunk, carries him when he is sated with wine, end quote. Now, I just want to say in a parenthetical aside that modern biblical commentaries put a lot of truck in comparative literature, that you should know ancient Phoenician, no ancient Semitic languages, especially the Ugaritic language, and we often find parallels, whether it is in legal material or non-legal material, between the Bible and contemporaneous literature. And it's often something to be learned from that comparison. And this author is about to learn something indeed from that comparison. So we just read that it's an important thing in Ugaritic literature for a son to take care of his father when his father is drunk, to make sure nothing happens to the drunk father, that he doesn't debase himself. He
shouldn't go driving.
There is no need to offer the excuse that Noah did not yet know the effects of the wine. Noah lies uncovered in his tent. To be uncovered is a disgrace. With Noah and his sons living together, it was the duty of the sons in such a situation to stand by the father, in this case to cover him, as a citation from Ugarit shows. It was a grave breach of custom when Ham saw his father lying naked in his tent, did not cover him, but left him there and went outside and told his brothers. This is narrated so clearly that it's difficult to understand how exegetes, which means commentators, have missed the obvious meaning. Many exegetes conjecture a grave sin on this sort of this sort in the part of Canaan. Like we just talked about, he castrated him or he sodomized him. But this commentator is saying, no, you don't need to say any of that. All these conjectures have missed the point. They have not seen that Ham's outrage consists in not covering his father. The narrative makes it perfectly clear that the sentence, when Ham saw his father's nakedness, can only be meant literally. So here you have an effort to find the pshat, the simple meaning, that although it later says that Noah awoke and knew what his young son had did to him, well, the not covering is a doing. It's an act. Just by not covering him.
He was covered when he woke up because the other brothers...
But he knew that the other brothers...
But when he woke up and saw what he had done to him, how would he know? Because the other brothers had covered him up. So how did he know who covered him and who didn't?
He told them.
That's a good question. Noah wakes up from his sleep and is sober again. He learns what his younger son had done to him. How is that important for the narrative? He pronounces a curse over him. What do you say to that, Marcia?
Well, I think it's a little bit further. I think that Noah woke up, found out that Ham had gone in, had seen what he had seen, and then went out and told.
Yeah.
So the other brothers came in, and I think it's a combination, not only what he saw, but that he went out and told the brothers what, you know what I mean? So,
okay.
He didn't do the cover himself.
So, one, he's mad that he didn't just cover him. One, he's mad that he actually stood there and watched him. Mm-hmm. And one, he's mad that he told his brothers. So I think it's like a three-part
mm-hmm. Well, Robert, you wanted to...
Also, there's no real timeline here. Just as he walks, he sees his cover, he says, how did I get covered?
Right.
Yeah, who covered me?
Right.
And Robert said, well, we did. He told me you were naked, I came in and covered you.
So Gilda is saying, wait a second, the sin isn't bad enough to merit this punishment.
Oh, but read the beginning of this where it says it's one of the best things the son can do is take him by the hand.
Mm-hmm. You know, take care of him.
But still, she's right. It is a sin of omission, not a sin of commission.
He saw Nagus that had covered. He went outside and told his brothers, hey, look what I
just
saw.
Look
at daddy. Instead of doing what a good son should do, cover the dad and keep quiet about it. He did two things wrong. He didn't cover him, but he told his brothers about it.
And we don't know if Noah has a temper.
Ignores a temper. Okay.
Overreacts immediately.
I want to give a methodological pointer here. If we're searching for what we call the pshat, the simple meaning of the verses, one of the signs of a simple, straightforward reading is that it doesn't have to add material and facts or assumptions that are not written. Now, when we learned the opinions of the rabbis in the Talmud, one say he castrated him, one says that he sodomized him, some of us might have thought, but that's not written in the text, it's going too far. And then comes this modern commentator, Klaus Westermann, and says, I have a better interpretation. I have an interpretation that doesn't add additional material to the text. The text says he saw, that's what it is, he saw. But then with Marsha's question, we started realizing that even this commentator we're learning now, Klaus Westermann, he's also adding material to the text because he has to add what he puts in parentheses. How is not important for the narrative. How Noah found out. But we have to, if we say the sin was only seeing and not covering, but how did Noah know that his son saw and that we have to add to the text that someone told him? So what I'm trying to point out is that although at first glance it appears that Klaus Westermann's commentary is quote-unquote better,
he's
still. Because it doesn't add extraneous material. But it does add extraneous material. It does.
But less.
Okay, that's a matter of interpretation.
Maybe Joseph goes back to like not honoring the father. You know, like,
it's a question of morality.
He didn't honor his father. He didn't follow Ten Commandments. So maybe because you didn't honor your father, that's a sin to curse your child.
Yeah, okay, but still, how did Noah know? Whereas if we say it was a matter of sodomization or castration, we don't have to add into the text that someone told him what was done. He experienced it, and he sees it. Right? If it's castration, he sees it. If it's sodomization, he experienced it. And even though he was drunk, when he wakes up, he knows what happens to him.
How does he know that it's common?
Exactly.
How does
he know that
How does he know that that Ham did it? Well, look, whether it's sodomization or castration, it requires some amount of time to be done. And Noah saw that the person that was doing it to him. Well, if it's just a matter of not covering him, all Ham had to do is peek in the tent, and Noah might not have seen that someone peeked in the tent.
Was his wife here with him?
We don't.
We haven't gotten to the wife yet. She's waiting in the wings for the next midrash.
But you know, it could be the wife had something to do with it. Maybe she's protecting for three.
Three sons are in the hierarchy.
Those three sons get, if they're
home. She doesn't want to work.
Okay, so
she is there with him.
It's like
why is she stopping him?
Good question.
Screaming.
Okay, I see you guys really want to get to the woman in the story. I wonder why. Okay, so here we go. We're going to come to the woman in the story by way of Louis Farrakhan, if I'm pronouncing his name properly. He's going to bring us to the woman in the story. So let's turn in the booklet to page 60.
Just say that Jacob and Esau had their moment in history because the mom put one ahead of the other. And it could for some reason happen here that this wife or woman is trying to protect the three sons that are in existence and prevent a fight.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So here we go. We're reading on page 60. See where I am? Page 60?
Yeah.
Until Jews apologize for their hand in that ugly slave trade, and until the Jewish rabbis and the Talmudic scholars that made up the Hamitic myth, the myth of Ham, that we, meaning the blacks, were the children of Ham, doomed and cursed to be hewers of wood and drawers of water, in other words, to be slaves, until they apologize, then I have nothing to apologize for. And another quote from someplace else. You don't mention the horror of our suffering. Here's why. It's because of something called the Hamitic curse. Now I know that this is kind of rough, but according to the Babylonian scholars, writers of the Talmud, not the Torah, but Talmud, I want you to listen. Look at this now. The Hamitic curse was written in the Talmud 400 years after the birth of Jesus. And the way they wrote it was, I got to find the exact words because it's really powerful. Oh Lord, let me find it. I'm going to take my time. Oh boy, I'm going to say the Talmud they talk about because he looked at Noah in that condition, in other words, Ham, and marked the redness of his eyes, the turning of his head made these kinks in his hair, the thickness of his lips. That's our features. We are black and cursed.
Oh,
so Louis Farrakhan is saying that, well, what is he saying? What is he saying?
They're cursed because
that Noah was black.
No, they're cursed.
And he looked at Noah, that the son looked at Noah, saw him in that way, and made the son.
No, that the black people are cursed because of what Ham did to Noah.
Black people are cursed because of what Ham did to Noah. But more than that, that black people got their features from this story. Right? And one more quote from Louis Farrakhan. Dewey, Kant, and Hegel, and the rabbis that wrote the Talmud, make blacks inferior.
Okay.
So the question is there any basis to these accusations? So let's again think of the story in the Torah. Is there any mention of blackness in the story in the Torah? No, there's not. But wait a second. Let's go back to a verse we read about 20 minutes ago and that we mentioned last week. Chapter 10, verse 6. Let's look at chapter 10, verse 6.
Descendants.
Right. Chapter 10, verse 6. The descendants of Ham were Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan.
Are we in Leviticus?
Yes, we're in Genesis, sorry.
Oh, Genesis, okay.
The Israelis called the blacks Cushim. Right. What blacks do Israelis know? Ethiopians.
Yeah.
Indeed, when it says here Cush, that's traditionally understood to be Ethiopia. Mitzrayim is Egypt. And although there have been many different foreigners who've ruled Egypt, the original Egyptians are black. Put here is understood to be Libya. Black. In other words, the descendants of Ham are African and they're black. Except, of course, Canaan isn't. Canaan is there in the tip of Africa, in the land bridge between Africa and Asia, the land of Israel. And as far as I know, the original Canaanites were not known to be black. But it turns out that Ham's children, in other words, the sinner's children are black. So put, say it again? Ah, okay. So put two and two together. That what we might be able to see here.
The rest aren't.
Well.
I don't know.
It happens, exactly.
But
it didn't happen to
be. I'm going to say something. I'm going to say something, and I want you to point at the fallacy of what I'm saying. It's going to sound plausible, but there's going to be a logical fallacy in what I'm going to say. That we could say there's a certain connection here between the curse of slavery and the quote-unquote curse of blackness. Wait a second. What's the fallacy in what I said? Textually. I'm talking textually. What is the fallacy in the following statement that Louis Farrakhan seems to be making? That there's a certain connection here between blackness and the curse of slavery. Say it again? Textually, in this text. In this text. Is there a connection between blackness and slavery?
Because
Cush wasn't a slave and Canaan wasn't wasn't black.
Right.
You hear what we're saying? And Ham committed the crime, but Ham is not cursed.
Right.
Now, Ham has four sons. Three of those sons are black, but they're not cursed.
Right.
The one son that is cursed is the one that's specifically not black. So that means at first glance you might say, this is a story of a curse of slavery, and it's a story that involves blackness. But if we look deeper, we see that actually there's a separation here. Those who are black aren't cursed, and those who are cursed aren't black. So it's easy to fall into that fallacy, but textually it doesn't seem to fit. Now, remember, Louis Farrakhan wasn't accusing the verses, he was accusing the Talmud. Perhaps there's something to what he's saying. So let's go on now to the Talmudic passage that he knows and we don't yet know. So this is in our booklet on page 61. And this is going to be powerful stuff. Page 61. This is Midrash Rabbah from the land of Israel, the 3rd to the 10th centuries. On the verse in his tent, and as Marsha pointed out a few minutes ago, we talked last week, and all of you wanted to get to this, we talked last week that it says in Hebrew, Ohala. The consonants are Ohala, her tent, even though the vocalization is Ohalo, his tent. There's some hint there that Mrs. Noach might be involved, or at least Mr. Noach is in Mrs. Noach's tent. So, in the verse, when read as spelled and not as dotted, dotted means vocalized, it is written in her tent, indicating in his wife's tent. That is the heading of what we're about to read. And now we're going to read two different opinions. If I were writing this, I would have begun now a new paragraph. Rav Huna quoted, I would begin a new paragraph. Because now we read the heading, and now one of the two opinions that fall under that heading. Rav Huna quoted Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yossi of the Galil, saying, when Noach left the ark, the lion struck him and wounded him. We have a midrash that says that Noach was injured by the lion. One of the variations says that Noach once was late feeding the lion and the lion struck him. Another midrash says after he left the ark on the way out. In any case, he was wounded. And where do you think Noach was wounded? Well, lo and behold, Noach was somehow sexually impaired by the lion, according to this midrash. When he came to have relations with his wife, his semen was scattered, means he was impotent, and he was embarrassed. What does this have to do with Ham?
Nothing. Well, he saw him.
That's what Ham saw. In other words, this midrash is saying it's not just that Ham saw his father's nakedness, he saw his father in his mother's tent. He saw them in the act of relations. And not only that, he saw his father failing sexually. That's what he saw. That could be embarrassing to say the least. And that can certainly arouse the wrath of Noach. His innermost secret has been discovered.
And then telling the sons about it is even worse.
Right. Now look at the second opinion. Rav Huna said in the name of Rav Yosef. And this is all under the heading of Noah being in Mrs. Noach's tent. But it's about Mr. and Mrs. Noach having sex together, but it's not about Noach being sexually impotent. It's a different opinion. What's the opinion of Rav Huna? Rav Huna said in the name of Rav Yosef, Noach said, you prevented me from doing that which is done in the dark. Accordingly, that same man, in other words, you, will be ugly and dark, black. Let's think what's happening. Noach, again, is not sexually impaired. Forget about the midrash about the lion. Noach is in Mrs. Noach's tent. They're doing what they should be doing. Remember, we said last week that the rabbis say there's a prohibition of sexual intercourse all the years they're in the ark. They come out of the ark. Mr. Noach goes into Mrs. Noach's tent. And then comes in Ham. He opens the door of his mother's tent. And I guess what it means is this prevents them from intimacy. Either because Ham intended to prevent them or just accidentally. And Noach curses his son. And Noach says, you prevented me from doing what's done in the dark. I'm going to make you dark.
So that's how...
Yes, continue the sentence.
That's how the black people came to be.
That's how the black people came to be, according to this midrash.
According to Lewis Farrakhan.
According to one particular rabbi in one particular midrash in one particular collection, right? There's lots of opinions in the Talmud, lots of different things. We've seen Rav, we've seen Shmuel, we saw Rav Huna quoting Rabbi Eliezer, and now we see Rav Huna quoting Rav Yosef, that there's a second curse here. It's not just the curse of slavery, which is visited upon the grandson, Canaan, but this text claims that even though the text never says that Noah cursed the perpetrator, we all ask ourselves, why did Noah curse the perpetrator, right? We asked ourselves last week, if Ham did it, why didn't he get a curse? This midrash claims that there is a curse to the perpetrator. The curse is, you're going to be black. That's your curse. Let's think a second. The Hebrew word used here for black is, it's the last word at the bottom of the page in Hebrew, at the bottom of 61. See the word umifucham. It means charcoaled. charcoaled. And the reason the rabbi uses the word charcoaled is because the last two letters of the word charcoaled are ham. Ham. He made a mifucham. He made ham mifucham. He made ham black. And by the way, even without this little plain words, the word ham in Hebrew, chum, means brown. Means brown. And indeed we saw that three of the four sons of Ham are chum. So this is what you might call a racist text, because it sees skin color as a curse. It sees skin color as a curse. But what it doesn't do, it doesn't connect this to slavery. Because remember, the three of the four sons that are cursed with brownness are not the sons that are cursed with slavery. Remember that it's Canaan. Let me say it different. We have the son Ham, who's cursed with blackness. But as we read that he had four sons, three of the four sons were indeed black. Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. But one son, Canaan, is not black, and he's the one that is a slave. So we have a curse of slavery and we have a curse of blackness, but they're not connected.
The people, this grill, but don't other people who aren't Anglos, when they're reading Adam and Eve and all that, I mean, the African Americans, when they're reading that, do they just assume that they're white? Or in their minds, are they black?
It's a good question. It's a good question. I don't know. But what I want to add is that this text seems to be finding a scriptural foundation for some type of well-entrenched cultural prejudice. And here we have to go back 2,000 years ago and talk about when the white men of the Roman Empire, when white Jews of the land of Israel, Babylonia, when they first came in contact with blacks, which is when you have the Pax Romana, about the time of the birth of Jesus, when there are less and less white slaves available because there's less and less war going on, and a slave trade develops with sub-Sahara Africa, with Roman armies going and capturing slaves. And it, as the years go on, more and more of the slaves on the slave market are black. And black becomes a symbol of slavery. Black becomes a symbol of inferiority. We know in the writings of the early church fathers, the devil is black. Black becomes a symbol of sin. We have it in our culture today, right? And as part of that, apparently, comes Rav Huna here, right, in the name of Rav Yosef, and says that, well, how did blacks get to be black? How did they get that bad color, that color of people who are inferior? It's part of the curse. And look, it's even in his name. His name, Ham. Ham is chum, is brown.
But you have to believe this. You have to believe that Noah could just say, you're cursed and therefore your ancestors are going to be a different kind.
Yeah. And Noah had that power.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm not asking you to believe that, but what I am asking is that we understand that Louis Farrakhan is not making it up. He's not, as we say in Hebrew, or say in English, he's not taking a rabbit out of a hat. He's taking one opinion in one midrash of one Jewish text, and he's tarring the Jews as being racist, which is a generalization that's false, but it has a foundation. It's not a complete lie. That's a foundation in this text. This is one of our texts.
Just this one person who said this? I mean, all of the other rabbis didn't go along with this?
Well, we saw there's different opinions. In this text is Rav Huna quoting Rabbi Eliezer and Rav Huna quoting Rav Yosef. Earlier we saw the text of Rav and Shmuel, who didn't talk about blackness. Now, it's getting late, and I
thought Noah
somebody to say, no, it wasn't Jewish. Why are we getting blamed?
But the Jews, now I'm going to be the devil's advocate, right?
Okay.
The Jews brought the Bible to the world, right? And the Jews wrote this Midrash, that says blackness is a curse, right? So Louis Farrakhan can at least say that there's a certain Jewish text that has a certain tinge of racism. He can say that, and he's right. This text doesn't connect blackness and slavery, but it does make blackness into a curse. But we know many texts in our tradition, and part of what we do as modern Jews is learn our tradition and see some texts that seem to be more mainstream and others seem to be less mainstream, some that we can accept and some that we cannot accept. Certainly in the area of Agadah, of non-legal material, our learning is all about taking those texts that seem to develop a worldview that we can feel comfortable with. Let's just read one more text because it's really late. This is to finish off the story. And this is one that Louis Farrakhan was also referring to. It's on the next page, page 62. The top of page 62, Midrash Tanchuma. It's a different Midrashic collection. The top of page 62, commentary to Midrash Tanchuma. It says, and Ham, because he saw his father's nakedness, his eyes were reddened. And there's an assumption here that one of the facial features of black people is red eyes. Because he told his brothers about what he saw. Because he sinned with his eyes, so his eyes were reddened. His lips were curved, in other words, curved out, in other words, a characteristic of black people. Because he turned his head to look. He made a curve with his head, so his lips were curved. The hair of his head and his beard were scorched. In other words, like when your hair gets hot, it
right.
gets kinky. And because he did not cover his father's foreskin, he was cursed to go naked. Right? The savages of Africa, as it were, seemed to go naked. And his own foreskin was extended. All this occurred because it is God's nature to mete out punishment, midah keneged midah, measure for measure. So this is another text, right, another text that Louis Farrakhan...
It's too far a stretch.
Yes.
But again, Gilda, I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm asking you to be aware of the fact that we do have in our tradition texts that a modern man might see as politically incorrect and racist, and in the hands of the unscrupulous, like Louis Farrakhan, it becomes ammunition to accuse Jews of blanket racism.
So this was in the 4th century this was written?
Yeah.
So see how...
And it's probably reflective, or it could be reflective of a widely held cultural bias in the whole Roman Empire. Again, throughout the right. writings of the early church fathers, the devil is always black. Black is the color of sin, right? White is the color of purity. It's a cultural
right,
bias.
And right in the Bereishit, black is darkness, black is ignorance, white is enlightenment, white is knowledge. I mean, the analogies are right in the beginning, in the creation stories.
I'm trying to think, what do you mean black, enlightenment? Where is light?
Dark, night, dark.
What's wrong with night? I like night.
I love night. But he made night and day.
But we think of darkness, not night, but darkness as being synonymous with
negative.
Yeah, we see it, darkness as being unenlightened.
Okay.
Children think of it as scary.
Yeah. Yeah. But the very word enlightenment has the word light in it.
Light.
Light.
Right? Right, so it's a strong cultural bias.
I just want to ask, it says, he was cursed to go naked and his own foreskin was extended. Does this just mean to go naked? I mean, I want to know.
So to tell you the truth, I
what?
Skipped over because I don't
like
know.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Say it again.
My foreskin is erected, sounds like, foreskin is extended, sounds like he had an erection.
Or that could be, that's the fallacy that black men have larger...
Aha, that's what I thought it might be. That's
But is that a curse?
That's not a curse.
Right. In our culture of just the past 30 years, that might actually be
A blessing.
A blessing. Right. You get all these, I get all these emails, you know. Okay, so anyone else want to add something?
Interesting.
Yes.
No bound yet, but I've got to bring it back. First. To me, how measure to measure. The curse was from Noah, not God.
Right.
God's not mentioned it, so where are they,
Well, perhaps you could say that God agreed to Noah's curse and let all these things come true.
No,
wait a second. No, wait a second. Alex, wait a second. That's a good point. Well, you know what? The previous Midrash we saw on page 61 said that Noah cursed Ham. But this text on page 62 doesn't say that Noah cursed Ham. It could be that it's God that's cursing Ham. It could be the text means to say that God cursed Ham.
The text says he or
what? The top of page 62? No, this is not the biblical text. The biblical text doesn't have Noah cursing Ham at all. Bob's here, we have to finish. That's it. Okay. Good morning.
You want to get out of here?